This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Money Manager Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, December 8th, 2014 edition of Invest Talk. And the title of today's show is 7 Steps to Start Investing as a Millennial. And this kind of hits home for me because I'm probably maybe a little older than the average millennial. But I know a lot of people that are in the have grown up in the era where equity returns haven't been that great, and a lot of people, younger people, don't like the stock market. A lot of older people still, they're biased by how they grew up, and they came of age in the 80s and 90s, most likely, and those are great times for equities, and that love affair with equities has stuck with them through this last 14 years or so, the rough times. So, but, you know, the millennial generation doesn't have that type of experience. They never experienced the giant secular bull market for like we had from 82 to 2000. So just keep in mind, that's what we're going to talk about today and why millennials should, what they need to do to start investing. And even if you're not a millennial, you're older, these are all good steps for you to check the boxes to make sure you are ready to go out there and invest on your own. Now, welcome to our Monday Invest Talk. We are live, 4 to 5 Pacific Time. Everybody is welcome, whether you're a longtime investor or brand new to investing. You're welcomed here, and we expect your questions. And if you hear a term you don't understand, let's talk about it more. I can give you a little more color to it. Let you want to help you understand it in context. So you can give me a call. Our lines are always open, but during our live production, we can get you into a conversation. Our number is 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Now, are you an active or a passive investor? The fact that you're listening today would mean likely to be more of an active than the average when it comes to money matters. Now, I don't know if you're aware, but there's been a debate going on in recent years about passive versus active. And active funds are run by experts who select stocks or bonds for you. It's kind of like having a personal shopper for investments, and they do the work and they do the research. They also get paid a premium usually. Active stock funds usually run between 60 basis points and 100 basis point range, so 0.6% to 1% range. So what you're saying is that you believe that your fund manager is going to outperform the market enough to justify the fees, and you know great fund managers can do that. Most can't, but there is a good subset that can. But it's just about finding the right ones. So how do passive funds work? They simply track an index like the S&P 500 or a basket of companies, and it's pre-made off the rack selections. And because there's not a lot of thinking involved, right, there's to create an index, what's that index? Boom, I'm going to buy those stocks, and all of a sudden I've mirrored the index. And so the fees are a lot lower because it's not as hard, and it's just the way it is. So the fees are lower. Now, in times like this when, you know, everything's rosy, you see a big influx into passive funds, passive investing. But I have a strong feeling that the next bear market, you're going to see that trend reverse dramatically. Investors are going to seek out the advisors that can help reduce risk during the downtimes. You know, remember, everything's just a cycle, a flow from one style to another, from one asset class to another. And just like in 2008, 2009, Nobody liked passive. Nobody wanted to just be in an index. Why? Because the indexes were tanking. Now the indexes are good. And the active managers aren't doing as well. Well, yeah, it's just part of the cycle. Today, this year, it was a bad year for active managers. I have a feeling next year will be a much better year for active managers. So what is best for you? Is that something you want to talk about? Give me a call now or bring up your topic. Maybe you'd like to know the difference between owning a mutual fund and having your portfolio managed by a professional investment advisor like our company, KP Financial. You could ask about that or anything else. Money matters. It's time to get your voice on the program. Let's move on and take a question now from our 24-hour listener line. This is one that came in after our last program at 888-99-CHART.
Hi, it's Carl, a podcast listener from Massachusetts, and I just had a question on institutional ownership. I understand that institutional buying and selling is what really moves the stock higher or lower, but I was wondering if the current percentage of ownership matters. Like, for example, if 90% of the stocks are already owned by institutions, will that affect the potential price movement? And if it does, is there a percentage that I should be looking for that's in, you know, say, the sweet spot? Anyway, thanks. Love the show. I'll be listening tonight for the answer. Thanks.
That's a great question, and I think that's something we haven't talked about in a while, but it is very true. Institutions are what drive stock prices. You, as an individual investor, you buying, even say a large amount, say $50,000 worth of a company stock. That's nothing. That's a pittance compared to large mutual funds, large hedge funds, big institutions. Why? Because they have tens of millions of dollars to put to work. Sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to put to work. So your 50 grand is kind of nothing. So you're right. The institutions do move stock prices. Now, can they own too much? Yeah, I mean, if every mutual fund and institution has bought a stock, well, you know, who else is left to move that price up? All you have is future sellers. So yes, there is a point. What is that point? That's hard to know. You have to take a consensus of all the big institutions and whether they've, you know, how much they have allocated to a particular issue. Such as, like, think of Apple right now. You know, it's we own Apple for our clients in both of our strategies. We love the company. Pays a nice dividend, good growth. But I mean, after a 40% return this year, we probably aren't expecting a 40% return next year. So it does limit. Why? Because there's a lot of institutions. Almost every institution owns Apple. Almost 5,000 different mutual funds own Apple, including probably a lot of hedge funds and private equity firms and other types of institutions. So you probably shouldn't expect a 40% upside in Apple. And the biggest risk is, what happens if, you know, all the media hype and the positive feelings towards Apple, which I think are justified, turn into, you know, some major problem? Remember, had the antenna gate. Remember the Ben gate earlier this year, or a couple months ago, with the iPhone 6 Plus, and that it was bending. Luckily, that didn't turn into anything big, because I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I think it happened to a dozen phones or something like that. But you in names like this, where there's a lot of media attention, one little thing goes wrong, and all of a sudden, you know, the vibe and the trend and the feeling towards that particular company starts to turn the other way. And with so many owners of it, there can be potentially a lot of downside. So it's just all about the risk in that name. So if everybody owns it, there's probably a little more risk. Now, it's only one factor. I don't think it's, you know, the end-all be-all, but it is something you have to consider. And you do want to see stocks whose institutional ownership is rising, hopefully from a low level. Why? Because there's more institutions that are willing to back it, or that could back it in the future. So, yes, it matters. Is there a number on the max side? I wouldn't say so, but it's something to be mindful of. Now, among stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs, and more, it's been difficult for young investors to decide how to invest their money. 7 steps to start investing as a millennial. That's our main talking point today, but I have some other ones as well. I want to talk about the oil industry, and there's a recent announcement by ConocoPhillips today, and they're slashing spending. I want to talk about that and what that means for the industry as a whole. I also want to talk about something that the headline made me mad. After reading it, it doesn't seem like it's going to be that big of a change, but it's just a crazy, crazy thing that Fannie and Freddie are doing again, that they did not less than 10 years ago. And it's just they say if you're being an idiot is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. That's kind of what Fannie and Freddie are just announced that they're going to do. So I want to talk about that. And then I want to talk, I want to go back and look at some the boom and bust in the tech sector and the IPO sector from back in 2000, give you some examples, and where we are today. So it's always interesting to see that. What were some unsuccessful tech IPOs? What were the successful tech IPOs in 2000 in the dot-com era? What were some recent IPOs and some potential future IPOs and what that means? And then 4 things investors should do in December to wrap up the year. Those are my talking points today, but I ultimately want to hear from you. You come first. We want to hear your questions. 8899CHART is how to reach us right now with your money topics on Invest Talk. 8899CHART, 8899924278. That's our number to get through and ask your question right now on Invest Talk. So let's take a quick look at today's market. The NASDAQ closed down 40 points, the S&P closed down 15 points, and the Dow closed down 107 points. Oil was down a little bit. Gold was up about $7 an ounce, so broke back above $1,200 an ounce. Globally, stocks were down. I mean, it was not a good day in the markets. It didn't close at the lows, so that was probably the one solace in the market. It didn't close on the lows, but it has really been weak. You had the big spike on November 21st, I believe that was the GDP number. I think that's what it was. And it was much better than expected. And ever since, the SPY, the S&P has been pretty weak, and the Russell has been weak. The New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, has been weak as well. So it's just not the market's not looking healthy. You're still making lower. I think barely over 50% of the stocks on the NYSE, I think it's 55 as it closed on Friday, were above their 200-day moving average. So about half the stocks in the market are actually in a downtrend. The indexes look great, but this is definitely a deteriorating market. Now, the cost of living today, Child Care Aware said that in 30 states, the annual cost of child care is higher than tuition and fees at the state's 4-year state colleges. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. Whether you're an employee or an employer, you should know about the 401k solution from KPP Financial. KPP Financial is a registered investment advisor, and that enables employers to offer custom professional asset management to their employees for their 401k accounts. Find out more about it. Just go to investtalk.com. and click on Contact Justin, and then just write 401k. No one will call you, but you'll receive a packet of information by email.
8899CHART, 8899924278. Your calls are the lifeblood of our conversation on Invest Talk, and that's how you reach us. Just give us a call whenever you have a money question or comment.
Hi, Steve or Justin. I just have a quick question that I like to ask. I hope it gets answered over the air. The question is, when you're looking at a direct purchase plan or even a DRIPS account that you may have up with an individual stock company that pays dividends, of course, which one is more suitable for an investor who may have a financial goal for intermediate term, as far as, well, hey, I just want to use this money to quote unquote to pay a bill, far as like for retirement, or I just want to use this money for quote unquote maybe to pay a car note. Would that be a direct purchase plan that you feel that would be more suitable, or would that be a DRIPS plan? Which one also has the best, of course, liquidity far as for me to receive dividends, whether it's on a monthly or a quarterly basis? That's my question. I wasn't for sure if that probably has something to do with the company that you was going through, far as for the prospectus sheet that you actually have to read or would not go through before you actually sign up with a company. I really appreciate it. Thanks for answering my question. Make it a great day.
All right. He's asking the difference between a direct purchase plan and a DRIP account. They're pretty similar. The goal is to reinvest your dividends on a consistent basis. Let's see. I'm trying to remember exactly the big difference between the two. Now, I wouldn't, honestly, if you have a short to intermediate term goal, I don't think either of them are that great. I really don't. I think the DRIP plan is probably more liquid, because the direct purchase plan, that's with the company, and I'm not sure what the liquidity ability is. I mean, obviously you can sell them. There's not much difference. I don't feel like those are appropriate investment strategies for paying off debt or making payment or needing that money in a 3-month time period, year time period. Those are for companies that you say, okay, I really like, say, GE. I like General Electric. I love what they do. They're industrial. They're going to be around forever. They pay dividends. I want to buy GE, and I want to keep investing in it over the long term. You can buy the stock directly, and then through the company, and then the dividends are reinvested in the shares, and it grows over time in compound interest. And you avoid any fees, right? Because you don't get paid. You don't get charged any commissions on the trades and things like that. So I don't think that's a bad idea, for a portion of someone's money. But to say that this is the type of thing I want to open so that I have it to go pay a bill in 3 months, that's just not that's not what they're made for. So I think you need to kind of rethink your strategy there. If you need that money coming up soon, just put it in money market and save it. Or what I like to do, if I have some sort of debt out there that's getting charged interest, why not pay that early? Pay that payment a little earlier. It's like a mortgage. We always say, if you want to pay off your mortgage sooner, don't wait to the day it's due. Pay when you have the money. If I get paid on the 1st and my mortgage is due on the 8th, right? What's the point of me having it sit in my checking account for 7 days and you're accruing more interest on that mortgage or whatever loan it is? It could be any type of loan. The mortgage is obviously the most popular. Why not just take that money and make your payment on the 1st instead of the 8th? And so that's the same thinking everybody should have when they have sort of debts that they're servicing. It doesn't matter whether you have a high rate of interest or a low rate of interest. It's interest that you're paying, and there's no point in waiting until the actual day that it's due to make that payment if you have the money today. And you're not going to need that money for between now and then. So, I think the direct purchase plan, it's a good idea, but I think you're applying it to kind of the wrong area of your investing life. All right? 888-99 chart. 888-992-4278 is the number to get through and ask your questions. At the break, I'm going to go back over and try to decipher between the difference between the direct purchase plan and the drip plan. I know there's a difference. I just haven't looked at it in forever. And so when I come back from the next break, we'll talk about that a little bit more. Our main talking point today is about millennials and 7 steps to start investing as a millennial. So coming up on the show in the last half hour, wow, we're almost a half hour into the show. Jeez. Give us a call. We're going to talk about this, but I also want to talk about what is on your mind. I always say this, get your call in sooner rather than later. Don't wait till the last 5 minutes of the show. Everyone does that. Don't do it. Call now, ask your questions, and get your question answered in a time frame where we're not squeezed for time, like the last 5 minutes of the show. So give us a call, 888-99-CHART. Now, what is the difference between a bottom-up and top-down investing strategy? InvestTalk 101 is coming up in the next half hour on InvestTalk. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein, and I'm here to answer your money questions now at 888-99-CHART. All right, let's go back quickly to that last caller about the drip versus the direct purchase plan. There's really not that much of a difference, and that's why I can't remember what the difference was, because it's so minute. A direct purchase plan has an open enrollment feature, which allows investors to purchase their initial shares of stock from the issuer rather than through a brokerage firm, which is the same thing as the drip, but the drip you can do at any time. The fees vary based on companies. No company has the same fees. And it's not very, it's liquid. You can sell it, but you have to go and request it, and it might take a couple weeks to get your money. And so, like I said to the caller, it's just not a good way to be saving your money if you're trying to use some of it in a 12-month time frame. This is something that you do over, decades that you reinvest that money. So it's just not really appropriate. So let's go to Kiram in San Jose. How you doing, Kiram?
Yeah, fine.
What can I do for you?
Hi, Steve. I have a question. As the oil prices have been currently a 5-year low, is it a good time to invest in energy stocks if I'm looking for a long term, like 2 to 5 years? Can you recommend energy funds?
2 to 5 years? Yeah, I would say that's probably a good time. Could it go lower? Sure, it could. Oil is, I think it hit around $63 a barrel today. We think, 55, 60 is probably going to be the bottom. Could it go lower? Sure. But it's looking at the economics of it. You've already started to see some companies cut back on investment in shale production. And, at the end of the day, that's eventually going to creep into supply and reduce supply of oil. And that's really what the issue is today, is too much supply. So is this a good time to be invested long term? Yes, this is a good buying opportunity. But understand that it can go much, much lower in the short term.
What do you expect as the lowest point?
Like I said, I think $55, $60 a barrel is right in that wheelhouse of where supply really starts to back off, and that's when you start to reduce this glut of oil that we have on the global scene right now. And so I think that's a good area to find a bottom, but there's some analysts now that are expecting $40 to $45 a barrel. Now, I think it's a little extreme, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. So if it does go down there, you could see another 20, 30% downside in a lot of these oil names. Now, longer term, I think oil is probably going to be in the $80 to $90 a barrel range. But 2 to 5 years from now, you'll probably be doing okay. But understand that these are very volatile names. And if oil prices do continue to go down, you're going to feel pain. So how much pain can you take, Kieran?
Okay. So can you name some of the energy stocks which I should look at?
Well, I can't. I'm not going to recommend any off the top. I can't give you that because I do have We do have some that we are have on our radar for our clients, so I can't say that. But, you know, the simply, I would just go to, like, the XLE. XLE is the energy, an energy ETF.
Okay.
Look at the holdings there and try to search for some of those names. You can also look at the OIH, which is the oil service companies. Those are going to be the most volatile. Oil services are going to be the most volatile. So if oil prices go down more, the oil service sector will get hit the most. But if oil prices rebound, this sector will fly.
What about USO?
USO? Well, USO is an ETF that tracks oil prices. I wouldn't be buying that. That's not the way I would play oil prices because it doesn't pay a dividend of any kind. I like to have some, especially energy. It's a sector that there's a lot of companies that pay dividends. You know, I would not be buying USO over probably dozens other oil companies. So, you know, it's good to track oil and see where oil prices are going, but it's not something that I would buy for the long term.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
No problem, Kieran. Thanks for calling. Now, our talking point today is about how to invest if you're starting as a millennial. And the first thing is to make sure you are ready to start investing. And what does that mean? Well, first, it's to set aside at least 6 months of expenses. And then when you have your 401k, invest at least enough to get your employer match, because that's usually at least a 50% match. A lot of times it's 100% match, dollar for dollar. And so you get an automatic return on your investment of either 50% or 100%. You're not beating that anywhere else. There's no place where you can get a 50% return or 100% return on your money risk-free. So everybody should be doing that. Number two is understand your options. Where do you put your money? Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs. There are subsections of all these things. You know, based on valuation, you know, value versus growth. There's funds that are a blend of value and growth. Market capitalization, small, medium, and large. Location, there's foreign investments. There's domestic investments. Then there's private equity, real estate, hedge funds. Those get a lot more complex. So I would avoid those definitely initially for the first couple of years of your investing life. But once you start understanding economics and how interest rates and currencies and all these different things affect different asset classes, then maybe you can start branching out into real estate and private equity funds, things like that. But initially, understand your options and get to know those options very, very well. Number five I like is keep taxes in mind. If you're investing through a retirement account, such as a 401k or an IRA, your contributions are tax deferred. But if you're young, you're probably in a low tax bracket. So you want to actually move money into a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k if that's available to you. And number six is do your research. I think that's big. Because a lot of people try to jump in and they follow what their friend's doing, their family member, you know, maybe do some paper trading a little bit, read up a lot, have investment professionals that you follow, find the people that you like based on how they manage their investments. Are you a growth investor or are you a value investor? Are you okay with volatility, or do you like to keep it safe? What are your goals? And then do your research accordingly. You know, there's tons of great screeners out there, meaning, you know, pieces of software that can help you screen for good mutual funds, good stocks. FinViz is a great one. There's Morningstar has, I think, a pretty basic fund screener. There's ETFs.com. There's a lot of websites out there that can help you. And then ultimately it comes down to investing. You have to take action at some point. Don't be in a hurry, but have a steady plan to get from, okay, I'm not sure what I'm doing. It's okay, I need to do X, Y, and Z. And then once I have X, Y, and Z down, then I go to invest. Don't get lost in the process. A lot of people get discouraged. It is complicated, but have fun with it. Look at it as a challenge to overcome. And I know a lot of young people, they don't like the stock market because they've gone through a secular bear market over the past 14 years. And, you know, it's hard to get excited about, you know, not great returns over that time. But I promise you, in our lifetime, we're going to have a secular bull market, and it's going to knock your socks off how much money you can make. So you have to be prepared for that, and the sooner you prepare, the better off you'll be. Now, speaking of 401k plans, managing the company 401k plan can be a big burden for employers. And if you like to explore a way to lighten your load and provide a better program with more choices for your employees, go to investtalk.com, click on the Contact Justin button, and write in 401k, and I'll send you a big, nice packet of information that will, well, maybe not big, but decent size, enough information to get you on the right track and give you some good options.
Why not sign up to be an InvestTalk insider? Don't miss out on access to helpful investment watch lists and chart lessons. You get instant access to our library of webinars, updates providing valuable market guidance, too. Sign up when you're ready. It's free on investtalk.com.
Hi, this is Mark Collins from Lancaster, New York. I listen on podcasts. New to investing, and I was wondering, what's your take on Copart, ticker symbol CPRT? I currently have a small position in it, but I was wondering if I should drop it and move on to something better, or what your take is on that. I look forward to the next podcast. Thank you.
All right, he's looking at Copart Incorporated. They conduct salvaged vehicle auctions for insurance companies, charities, dealerships, banks, and other institutions. I think this is, it looks like a solid company. One thing I like is the consistency of growth in earnings. In 2008, it made 88 cents a share. In 2009, it made 84 cents a share, so it was a slight drop. But that's not a big drop considering we went into a recession. And ever since then, you've had a steady increase in earnings. You had a small drop in 2013, but overall, it's been a good uptrend in earnings. And I like that. I like companies that are that way. It's a $4.7 billion market cap, which is kind of a decent size. I would say it's mid-cap. It's had a big run recently. It hit a low of right about $30 a share on October 13th. The low was $29.93, and now it rallied all the way to $37.60. It's definitely at resistance. Definitely at resistance. So I think it depends on your time horizon. The chart is what I call parabolic in a lot of ways. It's up into resistance. It's going to need some time to get through this the $48 level. But if it can, you know, there's no ceiling because that would be an all-time high. The all-time high is back in early 2013 at a high of 38.26. So it's approaching that level. Now let's look at the fundamentals. It has free cash flow of about $200 million over the trailing 12 months. That's good. It's on a value based on how much the company's worth, about almost $5 billion. That's not huge. It's not a great value, but it's solid. Return on equity of 20, that's positive, but it has been falling from 32 in 2012 down to 20. Not liking that trend. But overall, it's a very profitable company. I like kind of the industry that they're in because, hey, I mean, there's always going to be salvaged vehicles, right? There's always going to be auctions. I mean, unless we stop using cars. So, you know, I think short term, there's could be a lot of resistance. And, you know, even going in the bear market, it could go down. But I think if you have a long-term time horizon on this name, I think you can do very, very well. But I think short, medium-term, kind of ho-hum about it after this big run. And it is a little pricey at a 24 P ratio. And earnings next year are only supposed to grow 15%. in 2015 and 11% in 2016. So it's a little expensive for my taste, but I like the name longer term. Let's go to Mike in Palo Alto. How are you doing, Mike?
Hi, Justin. Just fine.
What can I do for you?
You've been talking about millennials and investing. Mm-hmm. Have you seen how they do in terms of investing gifted accounts like a UTMA account? Curious if they do a good job with it, or do they find that they need to do the same thing that you've been talking about if they're doing their own money? Thank you.
It's a good question. It's investing is really about being educated and having experience at the end of the day, no matter what type of account it is. I'm sure there's great young people who are well educated and are able to handle that type of responsibility and being able to invest for themselves in a UTMA account. I wouldn't err on that side. I wouldn't say, okay, that's the way you want to go, but I wouldn't rule it out. There are a lot of young people who are very smart, very gifted, very well educated. It's just a matter of what their interests are. If they have interest in investing and economy and understanding markets, then they can do fine. But you know, the most, like I said earlier, are kind of scared off in the process, and understandably so. So it's just a matter of what their level of experience is. Now let's get to Invest Talk 101, and what is the difference between a bottom-up and top-down investing strategy? And it has to do with how investors go about finding holdings for the portfolio. So if you practice top-down investing, you're more concerned about the big picture. You're looking up at the top of the economic ladder, the national global economy. You're spending your time anticipating what major economic trends will be, and you're looking for opportunities that way. You're looking at industries that are being impacted by the forces of change, for example, the healthcare industry. How does the healthcare law affect a particular company? Now, if you're doing bottom-up investing, instead of looking large, you're looking small. You're thinking about individual companies, working on assembling the best collection of companies that they're doing great in them themselves, no matter what kind of the economy or that sector, that particular industry is doing. So that's the difference between top-down and bottom-up investing. Which one are you? Give us a call. We have Dennis in San Jose coming up.
Thanks for being a podcast subscriber, and we do want to hear your investing experiences. We've all grown over the years through our experiences, good and bad. You get to be anonymous, and the rest of us will enjoy knowing that we're not the only one to make a turn when maybe we should have gone straight. So we hope you'll join us on the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Let's go to Dennis in San Jose. How are you doing, Dennis?
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
I've been watching Yahoo, and it went down today. I thought this might be a good point to enter, or to buy Yahoo. I didn't know what you think about Yahoo's investment.
I'm not a big fan of Yahoo. The recent price move, I think, has a lot to do with, I know it has a lot to do with Alibaba. And I don't know if you've seen recently, but Baba's been cracking lower. Hit about 120 in early November, and now it's about 105, and it's not looking so hot. There was a lot of positive hype around the name, and I don't think that hype was justified, valuations, and so I think as Baba cracks, I think Yahoo will crack as well. And if you look at the fundamentals, I just don't think the fundamentals support Yahoo stock up here at around $50 a share. Now, back when it was around, $35 a share, that's a more reasonable valuation. But I don't think at 50 it's a good value.
Oh, okay. Can I ask you one more?
Sure.
Vanguard Natural Resources, VNG. Would you stay with it, or would you keep it, or would you dump it because of the oil drop in oil prices?
What was the symbol on that?
Victor.
Oh, VNR.
VNR, Vanguard Natural Resources.
There you go, VNR. You said VNG, I think. Vanguard Natural Resources. This is an oil play. Let's see, what do they do exactly? Engage in exploration, production of oil, natural gas in a bunch of different states. It's declined from about $33 a share down to $17 a share. you know, this is it's a name that, you know, it's a recent IPO. I mean, I think this probably has more downside to go. You know, it's the same thing I said earlier with the caller before. You know, it's all about where oil prices bottom. I think, you know, $55-$60 a barrel are probably where it will bottom. It could go lower, and if it goes lower, this will go much, much lower. And this is in the expiration department. And, you know, it has a yield of 14.5%. Is that what you're looking at? Is that what you're hoping for?
Well, yeah, it's got a good dividend, but it can't continue to pay the dividend if price continues going down.
Yeah, yeah. So I would expect that dividend to be cut. It's, you know, starting to become a good value. I think, you know, value-wise, it's good, but it can go much, much lower. I think this probably will drop below $15 a share. I think in the low double digits, maybe 12, 13, that's probably where I'd pick it up.
Oh, I see. But I own it now. Should I just hang on? Should I just hang on to it or dump it?
Can you handle it going to 12 from 17? And that dividend getting cut?
Well, if I hang on to it, hopefully it'll recover at some point.
Well, hopefully, but that's what I'm saying is, I think it will recover at some point, but I think it could go down to $10, $12 a share in between the time that it recovers. So can you handle that type of volatility? If you can't, sell it now and pick it up later. But, you know, it's all about what your time horizon is. Are you trying to look at this longer term? Or is this something that, you know, if it goes down another 30%, which that's what it would be, then you're kind of freaking out? You know, just kind of depends on your risk tolerance. I would personally sell it and pick it up later cheaper, but, you know, that's the way I think about it. And I would want to be in something that has a steadier dividend, not something that has a lot of debt and is payout ratio is huge. It's about 200%, and it's probably going to get worse because they're going to make less money. So I would get out of it. Thanks, Dennis. 8899 chart, 8899-242-4278. We actually no more time to take any calls, but I want to touch on a report that Fannie and Freddie came out today, and they're going to start backing mortgages again. This kind of made me mad. With as little as 3% down. Again, do we not learn, people? Do we not learn? Any housing market, locally or nationally, that needs to rely on 3% down mortgages is not a healthy housing market. 20% down. We need to go back to that and stay that way forever. I know it won't, and it hasn't, but it's crazy. They just do the same thing over and over again, and it makes me a little mad. Now, before we close the hour, be sure to sign up to be an InvestTalk Insider. It's free, and it gives you access to our whole library of InvestTalk webinars. The latest one is ready now, and our comprehensive wealth workshop on retirement preparation. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein. On behalf of Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, thank you for listening, and we hope you'll be here for the next InvestTalk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461.